Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Real love isn't about grand gestures. It's about the perfect pairing. So get out of here with that puny rose and get down on one knee with a dozen Dunkin' Brownie Batter donuts with a decadent Coca Mocha signature latte to match. If you really want something special, sip on a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' Refresher with a sweet Cupid's Choice donut. Take an arrow straight to the taste buds because Dunkin's bringing the love this Valentine's Day. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
So crazy about. It's just music.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cutt. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, it is that time of year, Jim. Lots of new releases, lots of hype, and a few quality records. We're going to try to separate the hype from the quality. Five pretty important records that we want to talk about today.
We're excited about this roster of records. What are they, Greg?
Well, we're going to be looking at this new chamber pop record from the December. It's a band we've talked about on the show several times. They are making their major label debut. We've also got the genre-bending dance pop of the Scissor Sisters, one of the biggest bands in England. But can that music translate to the American market? We're going to find
ironic,
out.
Ironic, considering that they're from New York, but number one in the UK right now. A couple of other records, The Hold Steady. It's a band that started out as Lifter Puller from Minneapolis, is now based in Brooklyn. Big buzz on this record as they tour. Plus, we're going to catch up with a blockbuster release, or is it? I suppose that's the question. Janet Jackson's eagerly awaited post-wardrobe malfunction album, 20 years old. But first, as always on Sound Opinions, we have some news.
That's a song you may have heard on the radio. It's called Here It Goes Again, but more likely you may have viewed it on YouTube. That is the band OK Go with the song Here It Goes Again. Jim, YouTube has become a phenomenon in the last year thanks to bands like OK Go putting up their videos on the website and then having them virally spread to millions and millions of viewers. They have become such a hot commodity that Google Incorporated has just spent $1.65 billion to buy YouTube.com. So what we have here is a merger between the biggest search engine on the web, Google, and the biggest purveyor of videos on the web in YouTube.
A little more than a year ago, the founders of YouTube, this guy Chad Hurley and Steve Chen, were dreaming this up in a garage, literally. I mean, this is one of the great Silicon Valley internet success stories of all time.
Well, listen to these guys, Hurley and Chen. They're practically giddy.
This is what them announcing on their own YouTube with a video. That they're announcing this big deal the other day.
This is Chad and Steve. We're the co-founders of the site, and we just want to say thank you. Today we have some exciting news for you. We've been acquired by Google.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to every one of you guys that have been contributing to YouTube, the community. We wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are without the help of this community. Thanks a lot.
And this is great. Two kings have gotten together, and we're going to be able to provide you an even better service and build even more innovative features for you.
I don't know. Just keep going.
So that's what it sounds like, Jim, to get a $1.65 billion stock deal.
When a little you're, bit giddy.
Not even 30 yet.
What we really have now is, like the rest of major media, YouTube is going to turn into this vehicle for you to sit there and be advertised to.
Well, Google didn't buy it to just sit there and say, wow, this is so cool, this underground phenomenon. Let's spread this kind of wild, wild west mentality.
No.
They bought it to monetize it, to use a really heinous 21st century term.
I mean, right now, somebody sends you an email that says, you know, you like cats? There's this cute, ridiculous video of cats. Actually, that's one of the first things that they had up on the site was one of the owner's cats. Endless videos of the owner's cats, right? You like Pink Floyd, circa Sid Barrett's era in 67. Here's a video of that. And you log on and you see it, which is a really cool deal, right? And I was like, I suppose I'm getting this video content for free. I you know, all right. I can't watch TV without being advertised to. The bigger problem, Greg, is the copyright issue.
Yeah, absolutely. What's going to happen here, and what has been happening whenever we've seen these deals where the big fish buys up the smaller kind of underground fish, we saw it with Napster.
Yes.
Sean Fanning was the underground hero of the moment. Now Sean Fanning is working in some office for BMG, you know, droning away and trying to figure out how to make Napster cool again.
There was a magical moment where the Wild West, before copyright concerns of the internet, if you read somewhere, such and such a band is drawing heavily from this 1971 German krautrock record called Neu. Right? You could go on your computer and boom, you could download that album and hear it. That's what it's like right now with YouTube. A lot of the emails I get from fellow music geek lover friends is, here's this video of Led Zeppelin taken from behind Bonham's drum set. Or, hey, Jim, weren't we at this Philly show at CBGB's in 1979? Look, here's some video on YouTube. Well, the problem is all of that music is copyrighted by the record companies.
Yes.
Greg, we did a story a couple of weeks ago on the show about YouTube signing a deal with Warner Music. Warner Brothers made a deal with YouTube to provide all of its videos, all of the videos in the Warner Music catalog, to YouTube. But the software is also going to monitor music by Warner Brothers artists that is being distributed on YouTube that isn't being controlled by Warner's. Well, so you took some video of a Warner's artist and you put it up on YouTube to share. Is that going to come down?
The explosion of creativity that sites like YouTube made possible, basically the same role that hip-hop played with the history of recorded sound, mashing up things, juxtapositions that you would not expect, taking previously recorded bits of music and recontextualizing them. Amateurs out there creating exciting, funny, watchable videos out of previously copyrighted content. Are you going to be able to see that kind of creativity now with YouTube, just another corporate player?
It's a really good question. I mean, OK Go having two of the most downloaded clips of all time. These guys were on the verge of being dropped by their record company, I believe. They were not a priority at Capitol Records. Now what you're going to have is record companies, just as they do with MTV, spending big budgets on videos that they hope are going to take off on YouTube, when it's important to remember the stuff that has been most popular on YouTube was made for no money and featured somebody's cat or a dumb idea like those guys in OK Go fooling around on treadmills.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Once again, the underground gets co-opted, but that ain't new. And hell, I would go for a chunk of $1.65 billion if I could get it.
I was working at a record store. I knew you knew the score. Some kind of deal is what we're looking for.
Greg, we've been dreading this day, hoping we weren't going to have to do this story, and now we are. Tower Records, which I think was the coolest national record store chain, is finally dead. It's been a long, slow, painful death. It's declared bankruptcy a number of times, most lately in August. It owes something like $200 million to its creditors. Tower Records had 89 stores in 20 states. You've seen the big, big record store chains like Musicland seriously lose their prominence in the retail music industry in recent years and slowly but surely disappear. The mom and pops, while they continue to shrink, you know, your corner record store, the ones that specialize and tend to do, specialize in hip hop or concentrate on DJ music, they're still thriving. Tower was in between. It was a really well-stocked and well-run record store. I was in Towers in probably five or six states. And, mm-hmm. You'd always find treats. There were knowledgeable people. The guy in the classical music department really knew his classical stuff. The girl in the hip-hop section really knew that stuff. But being neither very small in mom and pop, nor really huge national chain, it was in a bad position, and it's been on the ropes. And now probably some 3,000 Tower Records employees out on the streets. And no more Tower Records.
Yeah, it's a sad story, Jim, and it's sad because Tower, as far as chains go, really did try to do it right. They had deep stock, they had knowledgeable employees. The record industry, as we know it, retail right now, is dominated by those big box stores, the Best Buys, the Walmarts. 70% of the retail sales are through those kind of mega chains. And what's happening there, Jim, we just talked about a great album last week on the show, the dissection of Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. You walk into a Best Buy these days, and it's a good bet that you're not going to be able to walk in there and buy Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life.
If you're lucky, they've
you
got
may get the greatest hits,
right?
But you're not going to get that deep back catalog. Tower would consistently stock that kind of thing. The mom and pop record store on the corner would stock deep catalog. 1,200 retail stores of the mom and pop variety closed in the last year alone. This is an ongoing trend where we're seeing retail shrinking and shrinking, being dominated increasingly by these big box stores, the Best Buys and the Walmarts, and the stock in those stores is shrinking. It's becoming more and more difficult for the consumer to go into a record store and come away with a record that they actually want.
Camelot Music, Musicland, Strawberries, those were all national chains that have closed in the last couple of years. It was hard to really cry about any of them because they all concentrated pretty much on the top 40, but you couldn't find deep catalog or esoteric independent releases. Tower Records, you could.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune, and he's Jim DeRogatis of the Chicago Sun-Times. That is a song called Smile from a UK singer-songwriter, Lily Allen. It is on a record called All Right Still that if you walk into Walmart today, you won't be able to get that record either because it's not being stocked in the U.S. record
store. There's a legitimate excuse for that. Yeah, it's out in the UK but not out in America, although she's exploding. As I said, she was just on the soundtrack the other night to Grey's Anatomy, and she's touring the U.S. right now. Smile was a number one single in Britain. Can I be European and jet set cool for a second?
Yeah.
I was on vacation in Italy a couple weeks ago on the island of Capri,
uh-huh.
And all I heard was this record. Everywhere. I mean, how cool is that?
Here's where you can get the record, folks. Go to myspace.com/lilymusic, and you will find that you are one of millions of people to access that website and actually listen to that song. That song has been listened to more than a million times. She's got three other songs on her MySpace site that have been viewed more than 2 million times in total. I mean, she is the poster child for the UK MySpace.com phenomenon. She was signed to a record deal in England in late 2005. Record company was in no big hurry to get her record out. She was saying, wait a minute, I spent some time making this record. I'm going to go build my own MySpace site. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put this music out myself. I'm going to let people listen to my songs because the record company seems to be in no hurry to put my record out. Well, once she started building that MySpace site, word of mouth spread. She became an internet phenomenon overnight. In the UK, All Right Still came out. As Jim mentioned, the single shot to number one on the pop charts. Now a U.S. label has become involved in the record. They want to put it out. But they're not putting it out till January.
Inexplicable. What are you waiting for January for? It's a hit right now.
Unbelievable. She's touring right now. She's doing a club tour. She's going to come back in December. That will mean that she will have toured the United States twice without even an actual record out in stores to purchase.
All right. So, Greg, we made a decision here at Sound Opinion Central. Although the album has not had its official U.S. release, you can hear large chunks of Lily Allen's music for free on her MySpace site. It's not out in America, but you can find this music if you want. So we're going to review this album as a proper album review.
Her parents are relatively famous people, sort of semi-famous in England. Her dad certainly has a track record as an actor, Keith Allen.
Well, kind of an actor, a comedian, a personality, I gather.
Yeah. He was not much a part of her life early on because her parents were divorced. Her mom ended up becoming a movie producer, and she drifted in and out of a bunch of schools. She was in over like a dozen schools while growing up in England, so it wasn't exactly like a silver spoon kind of scenario
for
Lily Allen.
And in fact, you know, Keith Allen is known as a bit of a ladies' man and had many girlfriends. I think that is relevant because I believe that this is one of the great put-down albums of all time. Lily Allen is not a hip-hop artist, although that sensibility of I'm going to diss you out runs throughout this record, All Right Still, and in a very, very wickedly funny way.
Worked with some top-flight producers, Greg Kurstin, who has worked with Beck, but as we said, had to get the music out herself before anyone really started to pay attention to her. Let's listen to a track from All Right Still. Huge record in England. It's called LDN, out soon in the United States on Sound Opinions.
Track LDN from the debut album by Lily Allen. What an interesting conglomeration of sounds. You know, you've got that 60s jet set space age bachelor pad exotica lounge music kind of thing happening. The horns are delightful. At other points in the record, you hear some ska, some reggae, you hear some new wave. Her favorite bands of all time, she told me, are the Specials, Rip Rig and Panic, Reckless Eric and Blondie. All of this is coming in there, but the thing that really sets it apart is her attitude. It's a particular vocal style that you really heard in the 60s on the soundtrack of those kind of, you know, jet set romantic comedies. You know, it was disaffected. I am so cool and nonchalant. I believe it is called Al Fresco. I mean, it's so, that kills me. And there's not a bad track on this album. Some of the others are really hitting guys at the pub who are hitting on her, and she just turns to them and devastates them with a variety of insults, some of which we probably can't repeat on the air, but she does not pull punches.
Some poor slob had the misfortune of breaking up with her right before she started writing and recording all these songs, and she had a kind of a devastating breakup. She had a nervous breakdown as a result of this first big love of her life. She was only a teenager, only 18. Ended up writing these really kind of, as you said, very pithily, nasty songs coated in this kind of sunny pop glow. So an incredibly subversive kind of record with the breezy Caribbean thing going on, the lounge pop, and then these vengeful lyrics tucked inside. The attitude is absolutely winning. You listen to this and you can't help but smile when you hear a song like Smile. It doesn't quite sound like anything else out there at the moment, an attitude that anybody, you know, between those delicate ages of, say, 15 and 25, when you're going through your first romance and your first big breakup, is going to be able to relate to. And for that matter, somebody who's 45 or 55 remembering how much that meant and how bad it felt to get dumped for the first time can relate to this woman as well.
Absolutely.
Because the music is very
people
accessible.
People are going to be turning to this record for years for the perfect line to say in the pub or at the bar when they do want to dump somebody or reject a suitor. We're going to be getting a lot of use tonight out of the Sound Opinions record rating scale. Buy it, burn it, trash it. This is a buy it record, Greg. I love this record.
When it comes out in the U.S., definitely buy it. But meanwhile, go to the MySpace site and sample it for yourself. Lily Allen has done a very smart and prescient thing by making the music available on her website. Listen for yourself and tell me that this isn't going to be worth buying when it actually does come out in the U.S. in January.
There's a little more Lily Allen, a song called Not Big, on our way out. When we return on Sound Opinions, we're going to talk about the new album from the Hold Steady and the Scissor Sisters. Later on, we've got the Decemberists and Janet Jackson.
That's next on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
I'm sorry if you feel that I'm being kind of mental, but you left me in such a state. Now I'm going to do to you what you did to me. Gonna reciprocate.
That's the music of the Hold Steady, the first song on their latest album. The song is called Stuck Between Stations. The album is called Boys and Girls in America. Containing the line about boys and girls in America, let me quote it for you, because I think it's really the key to the record. It's a little lift from Jack Kerouac, actually. There are nights when I think that Sal Paradise was right. Boys and girls in America have such a sad time together.
Sal Paradise, of course, being the stand-in for Kerouac. On the Road.
Yes, and the record takes off from there. What we have here is 11 songs basically talking about a night on the town, basically boys and girls having such a sad time together, trying to figure out a way to fit in, to emerge from this as lovers and companions, but not always getting it right. This is the third album in 3 years from the Hold Steady, Jersey-based, New York-based band, but really their roots are in the Midwest. Craig Finn and Tad Kubler, the guitar player in the band, were in a Minneapolis band named Lift Your Puller for a number of years, but then broke up. Finn moved to New York, basically with the intention of not ever playing music again. Tad Kubler ended up moving to New York as well, and Finn and Kubler ended up being enlisted by a theater company to play AC/DC covers and Black Sabbath covers in between skits at a theater company in New York City. From that, they said, you know what? We really like this three-chord, basic 70s meat and potatoes classic rock. Let's start it up and just have a bunch of fun. Let's find a way to have a few beers and rehearse and play the music we love. They put out 3 albums in 3 short years and have become one of the most talked about bands on the indie rock circuit in recent years. Nothing fancy here. A lot of people talking about them as, hey, they're a bar band. In the same way that people talk about Los Lobos.
Rolling Stone said, America's best bar band.
There you go. Let's hear a track from Boys and Girls in America by The Hold Steady. It's called Chips Ahoy, and it's on Sound Opinions.
She put $900 on the fifth horse in the sixth race. I think his name was Chip Savoy. We came in six lengths ahead. We spent the whole next week getting high. At first I thought that she hit on some chip that she got from some other boy. We were overjoyed. She don't have to work. She can tell which horse is gonna finish in first. Some nights of painkillers make the pain even worse. Came in six lengths ahead. We spent the whole next week getting high. I love this girl, but I can't tell when she's having a good time. How am I supposed to know that you're high if you won't let me touch you?
Hold Steady, a song from Boys and Girls in America called Chips Ahoy. You forgot the exclamation point when you introduced it, Greg. Boy, what a piece of work this record is. You mentioned classic rock being the roots of this band. You left out the obvious influence. This is as blatant an attempt to rework Bruce Springsteen as The Killers just gave us with their last album. They're aping the Springsteen of Born in the USA, and Craig Finn is clearly trying to do a Born to Run. There's a drunk at a bar in the middle of nowhere, and there's sadness all around, but there's beauty and art in it as well. And what a load of hooey this whole thing is. It is bombastic, overblown, heartland rock. It's emo's take on the E Street Band. It's despicable. You know, there's grand piano and Hammond organ and glockenspiel. There should never be glockenspiel on a rock record, unless it's the Decemberists, but we'll get to that later. You know, I hate when rock critics do that English major thing where you're just quoting lyrics, but there really should be a drinking game with this record. Every time you hear a blatant Springsteen or Kerouac-like line, you take a shot. The problem would be you'd be dead of alcoholic poisoning by the third song. He's aiming for Kerouac's boozy brilliance. He is getting worse than Bukowski by 100. This is just pathetic. I feel Jesus in the clumsiness of young and awkward lovers. I feel Judas in the long odds of the rackets on the corner. It's like, man, who uses the word rackets anymore? What are you going? This is a horrible, horrible, bad, bad, lousy, not good record.
Oh, I think you're nuts. I was totally prepared not to like it. I wasn't sold on these guys after the first couple of records. I did think they were kind of a glorified bar band. Nothing wrong with bar bands. Just didn't think they were anything special. They won me over with this record. Craig Finn, I think you're selling him way short, Jim. Yeah, there's some lines that are a little bit ripe, a little bit purple on this record. But I got to tell you, there's a lot more funny lines and a lot more poignant lines than you give him credit for. I think some of the writing is really, really good, and it scans well not only on the record but on the page.
But you like Springsteen.
I like Springsteen, 1974, and I think that's where the quotes are coming from, circa The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle. I would even predate Born to Run here. I think this is much more in the vein of that early, scruffier, wordier Springsteen, but the music behind it is a lot tougher. When I mentioned AC/DC and Thin Lizzy, I think the riffing of Tad Kubler reminds me a lot more of that heavy rock sound, much more guitar-based than Springsteen ever was.
And how do you explain a song like Citrus, which is all acoustic guitar and the glockenspiel?
I feel Jesus and the clumsiness of young and awkward lovers. I feel Judas and the pistols and the pagers that come with all the powders. Lost in fog and love and faithless fear.
Well, there's moments like that, sure. There's no doubt about it. I mean, these are... I'm not making any claims for the originality of the music. It is very much steeped in mid-70s classic rock. This is about a lot of boozy nights out on the town looking for love in all the wrong places, for lack of a better way of phrasing it. I mean, it is a totally blue-collar guy-gal kind of scenario. There's nothing fabulous or fantasy about it. It's totally believable scenario that he's creating.
When's the last time you were in a blue-collar bar and saw a guy crying into his beer and thinking to himself, I feel Jesus in the clumsiness of young and awkward lovers?
I don't know, man. I went to school in Milwaukee.
And
I got to say, this guy,
on your feet.
This guy's from Minneapolis, and I can totally understand the Midwestern bar experience that he's talking about. I got to say, I relate to it in a big way.
Wow.
And I think he won me over because he's talking about believable stuff.
Well,
I believe this guy.
All right. On the Sound Opinions rating scale, buy it, burn it, trash it, I am not backing off a bit. This is a trash it record. And you?
You're nuts, Jim. It's a buy it record. The whole steady. Boys and Girls in America, it's a terrific record.
That's not the Bee Gees. That is a band called the Scissor Sisters. From their second album, Ta-Da, the name of the song is I Don't Feel Like Dancing, and it was co-written by none other than Sir Elton John, who is a big fan. These guys have a lot of fans in high places. Elsewhere on the album, some strings are orchestrated by Van Dyke Parks, and we just did an interview with Moby that's going to air on the show in a couple weeks, said they're his new favorite band in the world. Who are they? This is a group of real pranksters and talented musicians, cabaret artists, theater kind of people who put together this project called the Scissor Sisters, named, I should say, after a lesbian sex act in New York, but have exploded in England. Their first album spawned a huge hit in 2004 with an unlikely cover by Pink Floyd. Recognize this tune if you can. It was a huge hit in the UK. So now, after having this multi-platinum album in 2004, the Scissor Sisters are up at bat again, second time. I think what we have here is the equivalent, as far as 70s disco, obviously, and R&B and general AM radio pop goes, to what the Darkness was doing with heavy metal. You know, Darkness was obviously a kind of a sub-Spinal Tap spoof. The Scissor Sisters, I think, are on a bit of a higher level. Speaking of the Darkness, they're no more. Justin Hawkins has quit the band to go back into rehab and said the band's no good for his trying to conquer substance abuse. But by their second album, the joke was over. So the question is, Darkness, joke, funny, first album, okay, fine. Second album, nobody cares. Do people care about the second album by the Scissor Sisters? That's the dilemma they're facing. We're going to hear some of this music and then give our thoughts about it. There's a lot of variety on this record. If there's anything in common, it tends to be Jake Shear's very high falsetto crooning. People have a lot of fun comparing it to the Bee Gees, but also to people like Leo Sayer and the dude from Supertramp, the long-forgotten dude from Supertramp. But there's also animatronic Get it? Animatronic. Yeah, yes. She does several of the vocals on here. There's a kind of Gloria Gaynor-like song of female empowerment called Kiss You Off. We figured, though, we'll give you a little more Jake Shears because he is the dominant force in the band, and that falsetto does rule the day. She's My Man is the tune from Scissor Sisters, Ta-da, on Sound Opinions.
My Man from the Scissor Sisters. Right there, Jim, I think you can tell why they're bigger and much, much bigger in the UK than they are in the US. Just a little too camp. A little maybe too flamboyantly gay, perhaps, for the US audience. I don't think...
Definitely some gender bending.
Oh, absolutely.
There.
And they're having a lot of fun with it. It's a fun band. I really see them sort of picking up in the UK tradition of bands like Bronski Beat and Erasure, which sort of looked at sexuality and shined a very bright light on the gay community and celebrated it in a lot of ways with very flamboyant and upbeat dance music. Scissor Sisters are doing much the same thing, even though they are New York-based, and they're an interesting band. In addition to the disco touches and the obvious Elton John references, which is, it's interesting that John is such a huge fan, and they in turn love those mid-70s Elton John records, the Philadelphia Freedoms and such.
Yeah.
And now John is, of course, guesting on the record. They're bringing a lot of that on board on this record. They've also got some quirky touches that I kind of like. They've got things like, you know, jew's harp and banjos and these kind of like odd vaudevillian kind of instrumentation
if
on
you
this
read
record.
The thank you notes, one of their heroes is Paul Williams.
Yeah.
We were talking during the Guilty Pleasure show about that soundtrack to Bugsy Malone.
Exactly.
There's touches of that in here.
So they combine these kind of odd little touches with the up-tempo dance stuff. My issue with the band, and Shears is an interesting guy, a smart guy, but 12 tracks, basically sings lead on 11 of them, of that sort of helium-filled Barry Gibb wannabe falsetto is a bit much. I mean, over the length of an album, it gets a little wearying. I mean, there's just too much exuberance and a little bit too much of that flamboyance. Even when they're talking about things like death, there's a couple of songs which deal with death, Intermission, The Other Side, or Misanthropy. I Don't Feel Like Dancing, that track we played at the outset. They still turn it into a big party. You know, it's like these guys are up about everything. And it gets a little old after a while. I think as a singles band, I'm really behind these guys. I would love to hear their music pop up more frequently on commercial radio in the U.S. I think for your iPod, great choice. I mean, hear a Scissor Sisters track pop up every once in a while, but I cannot recommend the album as a whole. I can't say go out and buy this record. I'd say download a few select tracks. That's what you really need here.
I don't know. I think I like it a little more than you. I think it goes through the course of a night at the disco. It starts out very upbeat, gets a little darker at the end. It's shtick, but it's shtick done well, you know, as opposed to, say, the Hold Steady shtick, which isn't, I didn't think. You know, I think that they capture a spirit on AM radio at a time when Chic would be played next to Supertramp, and Casey and the Sunshine Band would be played next to Paul Williams, and Leo Sayer would follow ABBA, and all that stuff is in there all at one time. And if there is a weak point, it is Jake Shears' vocals. But I think it's a Burn It record, right on the cusp of Buy It. I really like it.
Well, we're in the same spot then. On the Buy It, Burn It, Trash It scale, I'm with you on that. I definitely think there's a few tracks worth burning. A little more Scissor Sisters, Kiss You Off, with Animatronic taking the lead on that particular vocal. We're going to be back on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with reviews of the new albums from the Decembrists and Janet Jackson.
There's something to be said for not saying anything. I've talked about racism, spousal abuse, empowering women, children. I've talked about a lot of things. What do I talk about this time? I've covered a lot in my 20 years. And I've uncovered a lot in my 20 years. But I want to keep it light. I don't want to be serious. I want to have fun. I know. I don't know. That's what I do know.
That's Janet Jackson with the mission statement from her new record, 20 Years Old, 20YO. This is her first record since the infamous wardrobe malfunction at the 2004 Super Bowl with Justin Timberlake. Timberlake managed to skate away from that pretty unscathed and go on to have a very successful career since then. Janet Jackson sort of disappeared. She had just put out an album at that point that had not been doing well. She never did tour behind it. And the wardrobe malfunction seems to have put her career, in a position of peril, to the point where the spotlight is on her from her record company, certainly, and from her management, to come up with the goods on this record and see if she can remain relevant.
You know, hard to accept, Greg, before we go on, that the wardrobe malfunction, the reason we sneer so much is because it's forgotten that the album she was hyping with that Super Bowl appearance at the time was her over-the-top, most blatant sexual come on. I mean, basically, her bedroom whispering in your ear for some 80 minutes. You know, way too long and soggy and saccharine. So excuse us if we don't really believe that wasn't supposed to happen, because you were in the process of trying to sell this big, sexy album.
And what's the significance here of 20 years? I mean, what does that mean? What is this 20YO? She's 40. She's not 20. Well, what she's talking about, it's the 20th anniversary of her, what she considers her coming out album. In 1986, she came out with an album called Control. This had been after she put out a couple of records that she didn't really have a whole lot of control over. She'd been the star of a television show as a teenager. She was the latest member of the Jackson family to be trotted out in public as sort of a puppet, of the family empire, rather than her own woman with her own thoughts about what womanhood meant. And the Control album in 1986, her collaboration with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who were then two of the hottest producers in America, the Minneapolis-based production team that had earlier worked with Prince, they created a distinctive sound for her and a distinctive sensibility that came across on Control and really established the foundation for the next 20 years, her solo career. So she's paying homage to that moment in her career with this record and basically looking back and assessing, where have I been, where am I going? I'm 40 years old now. I'm at another crossroads. We're going to talk about whether or not she matched the peak that she achieved with Control 20 years ago in a moment. But let's play a track from 20YO first, and it's called This Body from Janet Jackson on Sound Opinions.
Girl that you didn't see, just set the gun at me, had to try me. Ooh, you know I'm the hottest girl in the magazine. You do it, love the hammer all to yourself. I know you can't stop looking, so don't try to deny me. Maybe I can see in your eyes. You do anything if I let you inside me. What would you do if I came to life? Let me tell you, this body of mine, this body of mine. Boy, I'm trying to win your love. This body of mine, this body of mine. And you go crazy when you see me, see me.
That's a song called This Body from 20 Years Old, Janet Jackson's latest album. There's some news here, Greg. It debuted at number 2 on the Billboard album charts. In its second week, it had a precipitous drop of 74%. I think America's over Janet Jackson. But Janet Jackson is not over herself. In fact, the most popular theme on this album is, how to say it delicately, taking pleasure in oneself. She has a man in her life. Jermaine Dupri produced part of this along with Jam and Lewis. And I have to say, this is not my Diss Minneapolis night. I'm sorry I don't like Craig Finn and the Hold Steady, but Jam and Lewis have never sounded less inspired. They were really just punching the clock on this one. You know, what made Control so exciting was A, their musical innovation, B, Janet's never been a great singer, but there was a sort of self-empowerment. I'm my own woman. Yes, I'm sexy. Yes, I have desires, and I will give myself to you, but you're not taking control of me, buddy. What Control was about to me. It was a musical statement and a lyrical statement. This is just literally masturbation. This is an awful, awful album.
I mean, listen to the subject matter in these songs. So excited. She says, whenever you pursue it, you'll never hear the word no. This is a woman who was talking about self-empowerment, as she said right at the top. You know, I talked about racism. I talked about spousal abuse. I talked about empowering women. Now she's saying, I'll never say no. Whenever you want it, I'll never say no.
Well, she told us she wanted to keep it light this time around.
Wow. I mean, on Get It Out Me, she sings about, boy, you're so hot. That's basically the extent of that song. On Do It To Me, you got me hot tonight. Okay, yeah. So, we're getting the theme here.
You know, you could say rock critics are comparing it to Control, and it's unfair to compare to where she was 20 years ago. Yeah, but she's putting it out there for us. So why is she doing this, and what's the point? And especially in the wake of her being vilified. But there's none of that anger, and there's no statement other than that weird little joke at the beginning of the album about what she experienced in the wake of, let's not forget, a couple of seconds that were so momentous, I say that sarcastically, that they've got the federal government changing the way broadcasters operate from coast to coast.
Yeah, it was a silly overreaction to something that was covered way too much. But the thing is, Timberlake skated away from that because he continued to make good music. Janet Jackson has not. She was coming off a Duff album then. She's made a worse one now. She's got nothing to say. That's what's really apparent. I mean, 9 songwriters collaborated on that song So Excited, where she basically says, whenever you pursue it, you'll never hear the word no.
Yeah,
I mean, 9 songwriters. Yeah. The beauty of Control was it was her, Jam, and Lewis together in a studio for several months, collaborating, making a record that had a sort of an organic feel to it. Here she's throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. Jam and Lewis sound pretty played, as you said. Dupree gives her some a bit more of a contemporary feel on this record, but the record really bottoms out when the last half is just one drippy, terrible bedroom silk-sheeted ballad after another. It's really a dull record, and Jackson is already plummeting down the charts, and I think in a few weeks nobody's going to care about
this
record.
She's toast. She's history. You know, bring on Fergie. Fergie's a new and better Janet.
All right,
okay?
On the buy it, burn it, trash it scale.
It's a trashy record.
You know, Janet Jackson has made some terrific records in her career, including Control. This is not one of them. This is a trash it.
And under the boughs unbowed, I'll clothe in a snowy shroud. She had no heart so hardened, all under the boughs unbowed.
Ah, that is a song called Crane Wife 3, the opening track from the fourth album overall, but the Capitol Records major label debut by The Decemberists. The album's called The Crane Wife. It's a band that's been percolating in the underground for some time. An orchestral pop or orc pop quintet from Portland, Oregon. I think a lot of people viewed them as second comers after the Arcade Fire. Similarly spirited, lush, elaborate, orchestral, theatrical tunes. I think this is their big shot to shine on a major label, on Capitol Records. I mean, you know, the label that brought us Sgt. Pepper's, right? And Colin Molloy, the band leader, who was a guest on Sound Opinions when he was touring in very stripped-down solo acoustic mode, rises to the occasion with this concept album, which is based on, as I understand it, and excuse me if I condense some of it, is an ancient Japanese folk tale that involves a wounded crane and a couple that rescues this bird and how their romance intertwines with that, and there's some sort of magic cape or cloth involved, and the bird, of course, is a metaphor. I don't know. I lose it at that point. But I never understood The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway either. It doesn't really matter. There's a story here, and all the songs fit together. And the Decemberists, clearly coming from this tradition of elaborately orchestrated psychedelic rock, folk rock, a lot of weird instrumentation. We have lush violins and layered keyboards and intricately picked, finger-picked acoustic guitars, and it all comes together on these tunes. Let's play, I think, the most striking track on the album. It is called The Island, Come and See, The Landlord's Daughter, You'll Not Feel the Drowning. This is a 12-minute, four-part suite, which is the second song on the album. I really wish I could play all 13 minutes for you. We can. I think we're going to come in with a little part there that goes from, and I don't want to tip my hand here, but goes from the Yes synthesizer runs into the more, shall we say, Jethro Tull-esque part. I don't know if we'll get to the line about the saber and the bayonet. And
oh, we've got to.
There's the part where he rhymes arabesque and later on uses the word belfry. But this will give you a good sense of what the Decemberists are about on their fourth album, The Crane Wife, on Sound Opinions.
Down by the water,
spite and save all the landlord's daughter. Produced my pistol, then my saber, to make no whistle, or thou will be murdered. La. La.
Oh, isn't that great? Can I say the title again?
Yeah, go right ahead.
The Island, Come and See, The Landlord's Daughter, You'll Not Feel the Drowning.
Oh, four part,
by the Decemberists.
Four-part suite from the Decemberists that is the centerpiece of The Crane Wife. As you said, Jim, maybe the most ambitious album by one of pop's most ambitious groups, and that's really saying a lot. I mean, this guy's been writing sort of Victorian novels set to music for a number of years. Yeah. I mean, you know, you just don't get enough songs about trapeze artists, chimney sweeps, legionnaires. I mean, this is the stuff that Colin Molloy is writing about. You got to have your thesaurus in order to just to figure out some of the stuff that he's singing about, because he's dropping words all the time that are certainly new to the rock lexicon. You know, you don't hear some of the subject matter discussed. I mean, Bozenbell. I mean, okay.
Tull. Jethro Tull was using these words.
Yeah, well.
They had cod pieces to boot.
You know, the progressive rock stuff, and I have tweaked you and this band in the past for being a little bit out in the ether and a little bit twee. Mm-hmm. Not a little bit twee, a lot twee. I mean, it's a bit much sometimes, a bit over the
top. Well, you
use
a word like arabesque, and, you know, there's no way not to be accused of being twee.
Absolutely. But on this record, I really think they get it right for the most part. He is over the top, and he is wordy. But he's wordy, but he's never clunky. The words still, I think he writes the words rhythmically as much as he does for their literal meaning, and there's a swinging musicality to his wordplay. It's not all about, you know, look at me and look at all these $10 words I can drop on you. He's telling stories, but he's telling them in a musical way. And I think the Decemberists themselves as a band really step up on this record. There's some beautiful sweeping melodies on this record. I particularly love the way they relate to English folk rock, that period in the late 60s, early 70s, when bands like Fairport Convention were sort of reinventing, you know, those English murder ballads.
Well,
taking it into the rock context.
You know, Fairport Convention, Jethro Tull blew up to cartoonish proportions what Fairport Convention was doing with the ancient seafaring folk songs, you know, and it became sort of silly. December is, it's kind of amazing how they managed to pull this off without being silly. And I think that the
reason... They come perilously close at
They
times.
Come very, very close.
Yeah.
Very close. You use the word belfry, you're close to silly. There's no two ways. I mean, you know, my saber and my pistol. I mean, how can you even say the word saber and not kind of chuckle in 2006? But the reason, Greg, that they succeed is the reason that the best progressive rock bands in the first era succeeded. And it was the strength of the songwriting. And also the rhythms. You know, this is a very hard rocking record. That kind of rolling tom-tom groove that we heard at Crane Wife 3, and then the propulsive nature under that rather silly and over-the-top keyboard in the little snippet we heard of the four-part suite. This album rocks, and it keeps moving, and you're right, he is very rhythmically minded. I think that was what made the Arcade Fire's last album such a success. You know, it all came from the drums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they all remembered that you gotta rock.
Right.
You can be as progressive as you want, but if you're not rocking. And I think also, you know, we have this other very brainy and very hard-edged school of new progressive rock happening with bands like Coheed and Cambria and Tool, and that's all about the musical virtuosity, and they've forgotten the hooks. But you know, you go back and listen to those Jethro Tull albums or Genesis, the reason they worked is because they had great big hooks.
Yeah.
And Molloy delivers the hooks.
He's got the hooks. When he was here on Sound Opinions, he talked about his love for the relatively obscure UK folk rocker Shirley Collins.
Mm.
But I hear a lot of that influence. I mentioned the Fairport. I think that's where he's getting a lot of it from. And I love that sound. I love the way he's updated it. As you said, the melodies are really strong on this record. At the core of it, he's really, I think, developing into one of the most important songwriters of our time. As I said, I had my issues with this guy in the past, but I really think he's taken a step up on the Crane
Wife. I wish we could go back.
Probably their best album.
The first Decemberist review we did, where you just
beat me up mercilessly.
You were accusing me.
I thought
they
were a bunch of twee over
the
top.
Loving songs about posers.
Yeah, and I still feel that way about the
early
stuff.
So you're saying you're wrong.
I'm not saying I was wrong at all about those records.
You repudiated your earlier view, as you will one day about the Hold Steady.
Don't repudiate anything about my earlier reviews. The Decemberists weren't
that great. It's a big man to admit he was wrong, Cot.
But now they finally stepped up. Hey, you know what?
Can you say that part again?
A band
you just called
him
the most important songwriter in our... That was...
I think he's developing into one of the most important songwriters. Absolutely. I mean, nobody's writing songs like he is these days.
Sweet vindication.
He's stepped up.
Well, it's a Buy It record. I'm happy to say that.
Yeah, first Buy It record of their career, as far as I'm concerned. On next week's show, we are going to be jumping the gun a little bit. Halloween is coming up. I can't wait, personally. One of my favorite holidays of the year, Jim. We are going to do an overview of goth rock. We are going to talk about the important music in the genre that began in the late 70s, early 80s.
Because Rhino has this new box set.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. And we're going to bring it right up to date. What's new? What's happening? It's an international scene. We're going to give you the big overview, and we're going to give you plenty of music to play at your Halloween party.
Just in time to investigate some of the music we throw out there. You can burn it to CD and play it at your Halloween party. That's our goal. We got some thank yous to say on the way out, Mr. Cott. Tori Southside Malatia is our executive producer. Todd Bachman is our managing producer and director. Matt Fingers Spiegel is the producer. Associate producers are Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. We get some legal help from Dino Armiro, some technical assistance from Joe Dassault, and Jim Russell used to be a man in Janet Jackson's life, but now he's on his own over at American Public Media.
Thanks for listening.
Love isn't about grand gestures. It's about the perfect pairing. So get out of here with that puny rose and get down on one knee with a dozen Dunkin' Brownie Batter donuts with a decadent Coca Mocha signature latte to match. If you really want something special, sip on a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' Refresher with a sweet Cupid's Choice donut. Take an arrow straight to the taste buds because Dunkin's bringing the love this Valentine's Day. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.